Hello, this is Ian Wolfe, producer of Diffusion Science Radio. You can now support Diffusion through the Patreon support page at patreon.com/diffusionradio. Send me a message about the supporter awards you'd like to receive, or make a donation directly with the PayPal button, or click on an Amazon affiliate link at www.diffusionradio.com.
The International Science Radio Show.
We have a bouncer and the doors of perception.
The good, the bad, the ugly.
It gets pretty exciting.
The myths, the truths.
Toxicology.
Astroseismology.
Magnetism. The dark side.
Genetically engineered potatoes.
Planetoid.
Planetoid.
I love that word.
Hello and welcome to Diffusion. Sit back and relax while we inject weird and wonderful science directly into your brain. I'm Ian Wolfe. On this edition, seahorse sex and smart looms. But first up, here's the news. Every breath you take, we can tell what you're watching. Researchers at the Max Planck Institute for Chemistry in Mainz, Germany, sampled the air from a cinema and were able to tell which movie people were watching and which scenes by the pattern of compounds they exhaled. They believe that they've detected chemicals that humans use to signal emotions to each other. This has long been a controversial area, as despite lots of suggestive evidence of communication by odour, no human pheromones have been reliably and reproducibly identified. The team continuously monitored carbon dioxide and over 100 volatile organic compounds in a cinema, while over 9,500 people attended 108 screenings of 16 different horror, comedy, romance and suspense movies at the Mainz Sinister Cinema. Outside air was directed into the cinema through floor vents and out through ceiling vents, which is a normal operating practice. In the outflowing air, the concentration of over 100 trace gas species was measured using proton transfer reaction mass spectrometry and infrared spectroscopy. When people enter the cinema, the carbon dioxide level goes up measurably and then falls after they leave, creating a spike. The team were able to see little spikes of carbon dioxide going up in exciting parts of a film, corresponding, they believe, to temporary increases in breathing rate and pulse. Four screenings of The Hunger Games 2, with about 100 to almost 200 viewers in each session, showed the same increase in carbon dioxide at exactly the same point in the film. During those spikes, they found a change in the ratio of the concentrations of isoprene and acetone in the air. Acetone is a gas that is soluble in blood and water, that's been linked to the breakdown of fat in the body, while isoprene is an insoluble gas linked to the body making cholesterol. There was a spike of isoprene when the heroine's dress catches fire, and another when the final battle begins. This might be from breath holding and twitching, or it could be from stress hormones being made from cholesterol. There was also a large isoprene peak observed at the end of each film. It's been shown that isoprene is released in the breath when you move your arms or legs, so it was probably people leaving the cinema en masse. Regardless of the cause, the increase in isoprene and the decrease in acetone was the same across all four screenings of The Hunger Games 2. After the screenings of all 16 films, a data mining group at Mainz University processed the raw data through the 287 teraflop Mainz Mogon supercomputer. Audiences exhaled the most identifiable batches of molecules to scenes the researchers had labelled injury, hidden, mystery and hiding, each considered a subcategory of the label suspense. As well as methanol and acetaldehyde being detected in higher amounts during injury scenes, some unknown compounds of particular molecular weights were observed. These might be from perfumes and shampoos which were given off when people's bodies heated up, as their emotions heated up. The studies showed the strongest signals were from suspense and comedy scenes. The researchers think that perhaps from an evolutionary perspective, we have signals for alert, for suspense, and stand down, for comedy. They note that in the field of medicinal breath analysis, where chemical markers for diseases such as cancer are being sought, strong emotions might confuse the diagnosis. A patient's anxiety should be taken into account for any breath-based diagnosis. The paper was published in Nature Scientific Reports and was titled "Cinema Audiences Reproducibly Vary the Chemical Composition of Air During Films by Broadcasting Scene-Specific Emissions on Breath." You're listening to Ian Wolfe on Diffusion Science Radio. Send emails to science@diffusionradio.com. We're brought to you across Australia on the Community Radio Network and podcast over the internet on www.diffusionradio.com. Seahorses have males and females, but they have very opposite roles to other animals. Dr. Camilla Whittington from the University of Sydney is studying animal pregnancy and seahorses in particular. I met her at her inspiring science talk at Ultimo Library and later visited her office. I began by asking her, are seahorses pretty unusual in their pregnancies?
Absolutely. So we're doing a whole lot of research on a number of different animals, trying to understand how they give birth to live young. And seahorses are the most unusual animals that we're looking at because they have male pregnancy. Unlike all of the other animals that we know about, in seahorses, it's actually the dad that takes care of the embryos and then gives birth to them.
If it's the male that gets pregnant, how are you sure it's male?
That's a question that I get asked all the time because it's obviously very unusual. So with humans like us, it's very obvious who's a girl and who's a boy because we have this very obvious external genitalia. With fish, that's not the case though. So male fish don't usually have a penis, which means that we have to determine sex in another way. And so the way that we actually determine sex, regardless of species, is on the based on the size of the sex cells that each gender produces. So in all animals, the gender that produces the tiniest sex cells is the male, and the one that produces the biggest ones is the female. So that means in seahorses, we have the sex that is producing very small sex cells, or sperm, that is actually getting pregnant and giving birth, which is the opposite of all of the other animals.
And so for the seahorse, how does all this happen?
So it's actually kind of a complicated process to get pregnant when you're a seahorse. So the first thing that happens is that the seahorses do this very special courtship dance. Over several days, the male will swim up to the female, he'll kind of show off his pouch, he'll dance with her in this beautiful dance, and after those days of courtship, eventually the female will accept the male and tell him that she's ready to mate. And at that point, they will rise up through the water from the bottom and transfer the eggs from the female into the pouch of the male.
And about how long does it take for the male to gestate the young?
It depends on the species, but the very big seahorses, the pot-bellied seahorses that we work with, which are from Tasmania, have a pregnancy of about 23 days, but it can be shorter or longer depending on what the temperature of the water is.
And how soon can they get pregnant again?
That's the amazing thing. So seahorses within, you know, 2 or 3 days are able to get pregnant again, which is obviously very different to most of the other animals that we might think of, like humans. You wouldn't see a human female get pregnant within 3 days of giving birth. But yeah, it's very rapid in seahorses. So they're able to have several clutches of young in a breeding season.
And are the females ready again that quickly as well?
The females take a bit longer, so it actually takes quite a while to make a clutch of eggs if you're a female, so they take a couple of days longer than the males.
And so do you have any ideas about why this big difference evolved, why it is that the males are the ones that get pregnant, where it's almost every other species it's not?
That's something that's still under debate, and I think we need a lot more research to figure out exactly what's gone on. But there are a couple of theories about why it's the boys that get pregnant. One of them is that we know there are a lot of fish that actually lay eggs but have male parental care. So there's a fish called a stickleback where the male will actually make a little nest and the eggs will be in the nest and he'll kind of wave water across the eggs and take care of them. And it's probably not a huge leap to go from males taking care of the eggs to males actually holding the eggs on their body. So that's one way that male pregnancy may have evolved in the seahorses. And the other theory about the reason that male pregnancy might have evolved is that it's a way of the boys being really sure that they're the fathers of these young. So if they're the ones that get pregnant, it's only their sperm that are being added to the eggs. So the male's absolutely 100% certain that he's the dad. And so he's receiving benefits from this, what we call paternity confidence.
So when they mate, are the eggs going into the brood pouch?
Yeah, so I should describe the brood pouch actually. It's kind of like a kangaroo's pouch. It sits on body of the male, the lower belly, and the male has a single hole at the top that the male can control. So what happens during mating is the male will actually gape open that hole and allow the female to transfer her eggs in, and then he will close that brood pouch and prevent anything else from getting in. The male will gape open his pouch and the female will position herself over that pouch opening and she'll actually inject her eggs into the pouch like that. So it actually is quite an involved process to align the male and the female bits so that the eggs go properly into the pouch. And so for this reason, seahorses actually need quite deep water to mate, because they will rise from the bottom of the ocean to the top, trying to align the male parts and the female parts.
And how long do seahorses live?
That's a question that I don't know the answer to. In the lab, we have animals that are several years old. They probably live for quite a number of years in the wild.
So the brood pouch is not exactly going to be providing milk like a kangaroo's pouch, and it's not got a placenta. So what does it do for the eggs once they're fertilised?
Well, this was a big question that we were trying to answer with our research. So we were wondering whether the male brood pouch is really just a container that the male is carrying around, just protecting his offspring from being eaten, or whether he's doing something more. And so what we've actually found is that the dads are providing a whole range of services to their developing embryos, similar to the things that female humans, for example, will provide to their developing babies. So specifically, we found that the dads are protecting their embryos from infection because they're producing these natural antibiotics in the pouch that will kill pathogens. We also now know that the dads are providing nutrients to their offspring, which was a bit of a surprise. We found that the dads are transporting energy-rich fats to the babies to allow them to grow and develop. And they're also transporting minerals, especially calcium. And we know that calcium is very important for skeletal development in seahorses as well as other animals. But we think that seahorses might have a particularly high demand for calcium while they're developing, because they have to grow not just a skeleton, but also those bony plates that sit under the skin. And so that high calcium demand might be one of the reasons that the dad is helping out the embryos by giving them some calcium during pregnancy.
Are there some similarities between seahorse labour and the labour of other animals?
Well, seahorse labour certainly looks a lot easier than human labour, but we found that there are some surprising similarities. So we now know that seahorse birth has a number of triggers, including hormones like oxytocin and estrogen, which are hormones that females in other species use to trigger birth. And we also think that labour in the seahorse is triggered by stretching of the brood pouch. So very late in pregnancy, these dads have really enormously stretched brood pouches, much like a female human would have a very stretched belly late in pregnancy. And we think that there are stretch receptors in the pouch that are registering that the brood pouch is very stretched and producing a cascade of signals that then produce birth.
So they have contractions?
They do. So there's a number of really amazing videos online that people can look at if they're interested, that they show these males just spouting forth gouts of thousands of babies. They almost fold themselves in half with these contractions that they have. But it's over fairly quickly. So, you know, within 20 minutes or so, these males have given birth to 1,500 babies.
What's the survival rate when there's 1,500 babies at a time?
So the survival rate is probably very low. Baby seahorses can't swim very fast and they're easily washed away on currents. And you can imagine if all 1,500 babies were to survive from every clutch of seahorse embryos, we would be absolutely overrun with seahorses, and that's not the case. So with a stable kind of population that's not changing in size too often, you would assume that only two babies per seahorse couple would make it through to reproduce themselves. So a lot of them will die along the way.
And what do seahorses eat?
So they eat all sorts of very tiny animals that live in the ocean. So seahorses have a special fused jaw, like a little straw, that means that they can only eat very small things. They can't chew, they've got no teeth, so they actually have to suction feed. And they can eat small things like sea monkeys that people might have had at home as pets. And that's what we feed them in the lab when they're babies. So I will say that we're starting to do research into pregnancy in lots of other animals, which have all independently evolved live birth, to try to figure out how pregnancy evolves and whether it evolves in a similar way each time. So we're currently looking at lizards and snakes and even sharks to get a bit more of a handle on what's going on.
And if people want to look at your work online, where should they go?
So I have a website, which is www.camillawhittington.com. So www.camillawhittington.com. Or they can find me on the University of Sydney website.
If people want to get into evolutionary biology like you, if they're at school, what should they study? What path should they take?
Well, science is going to be very helpful if you're interested in evolutionary biology. So science in year 10, and then biology and maybe chemistry in year 11 and 12 would be really helpful. But certainly you don't have to have done those subjects to start studying a biology degree at university. So depending on the university, I don't know much about prerequisites, but it's possible to study biology even if you haven't done it at school. But definitely doing biology at school will really trigger your enthusiasm for all the exciting things that are going on in our world.
Well, Camilla Whittington, thank you very much.
Thanks so much, Ian.
That was Camilla Whittington from the University of Sydney talking about seahorse courtship, sex and pregnancies. You can find out more at www.camillawhittington.com.
He made his way and hopes someday he'll find someone to love. He sees I'm not afraid to
That was Seahorse by Jonathan Coulton. You can hear more at jonathancoulton.com. And then on to the CBIT computer fair, where I met Andrew Whalen with an odd-looking loom and a 3D printer. Andrew is the founder of RoboBuilt, smart manufacturing for fabric, using automation to make cost-effective, custom, bespoke materials. I began by asking him, how does it work?
So you'll upload a design, which might be a bitmap, to our website, and then we'll use our software to convert that to a machine code. Then our weaving loom will convert that to fabric, and we'll send that out to you.
Is that a slow process?
Yeah, it'll probably take about a minute per centimetre. So it will take a little time, but we can always build more looms if we get too busy. That's because we're all about R&D and innovation, so.
Has anything like this ever been done?
Not that we're aware. The weaving looms over in India, where most of the textiles are done, also in Bangladesh and places like that, they still use punch cards, which are very old technology. The Industrial Revolution kind of started and stopped for those guys. They got that there and it works for them, so that's what they do. So the problem is that they can only do large runs, which means that we can actually compete in the small runs by doing a bespoke piece of material for the same price as that piece of material would cost for a large run.
How high resolution are the images or designs that you can put into the fabric?
We're looking at 1 pixel would convert to slightly less than 1 millimetre, so that's about the scaling.
So you could do photorealistic things on the fabric?
Yeah, depending on how far you are away from the fabric. The limit is the number of colours you need, so we're trying to start with just 2 colours, and then as our technology improves, we'll start trying to weave in multiple colours.
So you're saying cotton would be the fabric you'd use?
Yeah, cotton, because it's a nice natural fibre to work with. We'll be using that to start with because that's what most of our initial beta testers have sort of indicated they would like, particularly around the fashion. They kind of like that as a fabric.
And you've got a 3D printer here as well.
Yeah, so we use 3D printing to rapidly prototype our machinery. So whereas 2 years ago we would have had to stand in front of a milling machine for hours a day, we can now come up with an idea on CAD. We can print it out and we can see how that works. We can iterate on that design and we're not spending tons of money.
So you can actually make the parts for your machinery in plastic?
Yeah, so we're using ABS plastic and that's good enough for us to make a first prototype. It's durable enough that we can run it for a while and it won't break. So we can do things like special gearings. So we don't need to try and source specialised gears. We can just put them in the CAD, print them and use them.
How long have you been doing this?
Only about 6 months. It's been a labour of love, and in 6 months, hopefully, we'll have a working machine.
Should people be looking online to put orders with you now, or how does it work when this level of startup?
So in 6 months, we're looking at providing samples to our beta testers. And so we want our beta testers to give us feedback on the process of ordering and actually the quality of the material, if they're happy with it, and get them to start creating cool things with it. Because we want to be a supplier to other creatives so that they can create things that we would never dream of.
Well, I can just think if you've got, basically you've got a computer control loom, then people could be making not just fabric with designs, but maybe shaped fabric, different sorts of clothing or fabric sculptures?
Yeah, so once we've got the basic flat cloth done, we'll be able to look at how we can add extra threads in special places to change the shape of the material.
So would you be doing clothing as well?
Long term, we want to do clothing, but when you start getting into that, you're starting to really big R&D budgets, and we're a team of ex-uni students, so we don't have a whole lot of money, we don't have rich uncles.
You could be producing fabric that tailors could be making into clothes.
Oh, definitely. We want to work with tailors to create stuff that's special and unique because there's no need for them to use run-of-the-mill, literally, fabric that isn't interesting, that it doesn't tie in with a company's brand or a person's identity. It's something that can really make someone feel special by wearing something that's made just for them.
Would you be able to incorporate things you've printed into the fabric? Would you be able to do anything where it's composite materials, like it's both the fabric and stuff in your 3D printer? Or is that not going to work?
That probably wouldn't work just because of the thickness of the fabric. But when we start playing with more of the three-dimensional fabric, we can start looking at how that might interplay with that, because then we're combining something that's 3D with 3D.
So if people are looking for you online, where should they go?
They should go to RoboBuilt, which is RoboBuilt.lt. So the domain name is just our name with a dot. We'd love for people to get in touch with us through our contact form, and we'll create a newsletter soon so they can stay in touch with our progress over the next 6 months.
Andrew Whalen, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was Andrew Whalen from RoboBuilt with his digital loom. You can find out more at robobui.lt. And that's all from us this week on Diffusion. Would you like to hear your voice on radio? We need more people contributing stories to Diffusion. Send your contributions, opinions, congratulations, helpful suggestions and donations to science@diffusionradio.com. That's science@diffusionradio.com. And please do send me an email so I know you're listening and you'd like to hear more episodes. Please like the Diffusion Science Radio page on Facebook and rate us on iTunes. Tell your friends. Follow me on Twitter at Ian Wolf. Check out the Patreon page at patreon.com/diffusionradio. Checking production was Charles Willock. I produce Diffusion, which is broadcast around Australia on the Community Radio Network, including 8CCC in Alice Springs and Tennant Creek, 2NVR in Nambucca Valley, and 3MBR in the Mallee Border districts of Victoria and South Australia. Diffusion is syndicated globally on the National Science Foundation's Science 360 internet radio station, and also on astronomy.fm. Subscribe to the podcast on the Diffusion website, www.diffusionradio.com. That's www.diffusionradio.com, and check the website for links, photos and videos about this week's show. If you enjoyed the show, then explore more than 848 previous episodes archived on diffusionradio.com, where the shows are labelled by keywords so you can focus in on the stories you want to hear. Subscribe to the Diffusion YouTube channel at youtube.com/c/diffusionradio. I'm Ian Wolf. Join us inside your audio device of choice for more science wondering next week on Diffusion Science Radio.
Science is fun. It helps you to learn, to know, and to appreciate. When you study science, you may go on field trips. You discover the marvelous interrelationships between all living things. You learn to read the history of the earth as it is written in rocks and fossils. You find out what makes things tick. Everything from a molecule to a living organism. In the study of science is found the most useful and satisfying knowledge of man. Knowledge of his physical world, its past, its present, and its future. And in your moments of relaxation, now and in the years to come, you will find the study of science leading you into fascinating pursuits. Photography, collecting. Why study science? Study science because you will find in the study of science a richer, more rewarding life.